back the exams. I'm going to tell you the mean first just so you don't get shocked when you see what the grades are. The mean for the exam is 43.1. Okay? So, yeah, that's right. Okay. I graded the. Are you gonna look at? Not gonna look at?
I don't even look at it anymore.
Okay, we're gonna go over it. So I suggest you, if you don't want to look at it, to look at it. I graded the first problem, problem 1A and B, which is only worth 20 points, but it took me 7 hours this weekend to grade it, so that's how I never agreed to be grading. So I'll be graded the rest of them. So I can answer very detailed questions about the first one as far as the grading. I'm gonna go over the solution for all of it. Grading questions in the first one, I can answer those. But the other ones, I can help you with, but Ali will be the one to make the final decision on that. All right, now I'll tell you, once I've given you the mean, I'll give you, now that I've given you the mean, I'll give you more detailed information on the statistics. Okay, so mean is 43.1, and the standard deviation is 20.3. Wait, no, that's not right. Sorry. The standard deviation is 18.7. Okay? The averages on each of the problems, problem 1, 11.2 with a standard deviation of 3.2. Second problem, 11.6. Well, the first problem was out of 20, this one's out of 40, so 11.6 out of 40, with a standard deviation of 13.3. So the standard deviation is bigger than the average score. And the third problem, 20.3 is the average, and the standard deviation is 10.2. If you're interested to know, our class average, we got all the statistics here, did everything. Our class average in this discussion section is 41 with a standard deviation of 24.0. So there's lots of numbers there. You can do what you want with them, but at least you have them. Okay. Before I even start going over the exam, I wanted to say something about what should be your approach to taking an exam like this. When he tells you that the mean is really low, like he said something about how the first exam last year, the mean was a 70-something, and that was a really high mean, so you know that they're normally lower than that. When you have an exam like that, your philosophy has to be different than an exam where, you know, the mean is like a 90 or 95 or something like that, or really high, because you need to go through and, like, just say, I got to pick up points anywhere. Okay, and this is going to apply to, the reason I'm telling you is that to, like, say, you know, do it differently, or you did it wrong, but to say, you know, you have a couple more exams ahead of you, just to think about it differently. When the being so low, you want to try and pick up as many points as possible. So what that means is going to the problems first has the most points. If you don't know how to do a part, skipping it and going to do a part you do know how to do. A lot of people spent a long time on the first problem. There wasn't anyone that didn't do the first problem. A lot of people didn't do the second problem. The second problem was worth 40 points. The first one was 20. People spent a long time like giving all kinds of information, explaining things really in depthly for the reasons for simplifying the energy balance, which is good in general, but when you have an exam like this, when you don't have a lot of time, you can't really mess with that. So just keep that in mind for future exams. You have one more regular exam and then a final exam. Oh, I didn't give you the highs and the lows. I forgot to do that. The high was an 88 and the low was 15. Okay. All right, now let's lower this. Problem one, we're expanding the energy balance like we've done a lot of times. We're given an energy balance, so we're going to start from that and not something else. You know, a lot of times we can start by using the book for a liquid or whatever, the more simplified equation, but here you're told specifically to start with equation one and expand it and reduce it. So you need to give reasons for each of the terms that you're taking out, that you're getting rid of. You can't just say it's a liquid and then write a more simplified form. So let's start with this form. It's the same thing for part A and part B. Fluids, what that is, giving the velocity for this plane right here, what it is going down in the z direction. And you're even given a coordinate system. So some people, or at least one person, I saw it use radial coordinates, which shouldn't because you have the information right there. Okay, so liquid film is falling down the surface of a cool wall. The other side of the liquid film is exposed to ambient air at temperature T infinity. Okay? T infinity right here, TS. Before I get into actually simplifying it, let's talk about physically what's going on. This is how you would approach it. You'd say, you know, before I can cross off terms, I have to know what's going on in my situation. So it's TS here right along this wall, and T infinity, anything in contact with this. Right? As far as what's going on here, you have to think about it. Right? It's not given for you. Now, you have to imagine this fluid comes in at some temperature, okay? T naught, let's say. When it just comes in from wherever it's starting, so it's all uniform temperature, which is a pretty normal thing to assume. And I'll draw this for the case of what the temperature profile would look like if T naught was in between T infinity and TS, and TS is higher. When it first came out, like the temperature profile would be uniform right there. It's all T naught. Right? And if TS is higher, then after some time it'll look like this. Okay. This is lower here, some heat is lost out here, comes in here, and then eventually this looks more and more like this until it's looking like this, like that, and eventually when you're down low enough, you'll have a straight line here, okay? It's kind of intuitive, for me it's kind of intuitive, I kind of draw this, but you could also, once you simplify the final equation, I'll show you why is that you'll know this is a temperature profile. But just, if you know that this temperature here is starting off, it's not necessarily going to be the same as either of these, something like this is going to happen where there's going to be heat transfer. transfer in the the y direction. Okay. All right. So expanding this for this case. And ask me any questions if you have any time, please. First thing is we know this is steady state because no information is given about it being at startup or anything else, okay? That's kind of the clue, and a lot of people did a good job on that writing. Because no information is given, we can assume steady state. So at steady state, this term here will expand in a second, but just seeing what we can limit it in this first one, the K has been moved out because it's we're assuming constant conductivity for this situation. It's not a function of temperature, and then you can do that. It's how it's been for all of our problems. This fluid is incompressible, okay? It's a liquid, so it's incompressible, which means this term here is zero. Okay? There's a lot of confusion on this term here for both parts, okay? So I should explain what this means. This term right here is zero when you have an incompressible fluid. So for a solid or a liquid, this term is zero. Alright? This term right here is almost zero for a liquid or a solid. Okay? So we have a liquid here, so this is almost zero. It's very small. This is zero. The reason why we take this term off is because this is zero, not because this is zero. Okay? Because people that did that then made a mistake on the second part. Right? You need to understand that. For a gas, this is significant and this is significant. So for a gas, both of these remain, right? But for a liquid or a solid, they leave, right? This right here is a thermodynamic property. This is not anything having to do with our system. For the second problem, people talk about the pressure being constant, things like that. You should recognize this from thermo. This is saying when this is the molar volume or the density, the same versus the density, is fixed, how does the pressure change with temperature? Okay, so it's not anything to do with the system, but just the fluid that's in the system, or the solid, whatever it is in the system, how does it behave when you fix its density and then you change the temperature? How does the pressure change? If the pressure doesn't change, that term is zero. If it does, that's what it is. You can write explicit equation. You can put an equation of state in there for a gas, which I'll show you for the second problem. But for this one, you don't need to. It's incompressible. This term right here, there's no generation given, so no generation. I was pretty lenient on people not giving really full answers, but just crossing off the right terms, except if they give, there are certain ones that I didn't look for the exact thing, which is with this, but I was lenient on the first problem, part A, and not part B. But this one right here, the viscosity times the viscous dissipation function. You actually don't really know if in this situation if it's going to be negligible or not. Okay, it's going to depend on what the fluid is. So I accepted both answers, but only if you gave good answers or good reasoning for why that's there. So if you said the viscosity is small for this, I'll assume. So if you said the viscosity I assume here is small, therefore this term is negligible, that was a good answer. Also, if you said, I don't know anything about the viscosity, so I can leave it in, that's a good answer also, because both of them are kind of true. But if you just cross it off blindly, not recognizing that it could be significant, you lost points for that. Okay? You had to recognize that it depended on the situation. And he says, clearly describe all assumptions. So that would be an assumption you had to make about that. So even if you kept the term, you'd have to give a reason for keeping it. All right. And the correct thing to do for this that wasn't even done in the solution, some people did, is expanding this function here and crossing off the velocity terms. And then you're actually just left with one velocity, Vz. is a function, dvz dy, which you actually have an expression for vz, so that was the best way to solve it because you could explicitly put that in. All right, but we didn't. You didn't have to do that. I accepted just crossing off. You gave a good reason. And so for this, we'll cross it off and say, it's not to do with the velocity profile. Okay, it's not that there's no high velocity gradient. You don't really know how that'll look. I mean, you have a picture, but you don't really know the magnitude of that. Okay, so it's the viscosity that's the key here. Okay? And so expanding with what we have left, correctly, that's what should remain. All right, from this diagram here, you see that the only velocity we have is going in the z direction, right? It's going down. There's no velocity in the y direction. There's no velocity in the x direction because it's not even given the problem. It's going back in the page. So right away, you can cross out vx and dy and just say that there's zero. That's fine. You don't have to give much of a reason for that. And because of that, because at least the x direction, it's into the plane of the board. By symmetry, you know that this temperature doesn't vary with x, okay? So you can cross that off. And the only remaining thing to say is, to be completely correct, and Professor Thompson talked about this in lecture, was comparing the convection term and the conduction term, okay? Saying that this term here, the conduction, is negligible compared to convection, something like that. You could leave it in. We didn't take off if you left it in, but the most correct thing, and actually one person did this that I saw, is saying that this term was negligible compared to this, okay? I hope that makes sense. You can't say that there's no temperature variation in the z direction, because if you look at how I drew the temperature profile, you can see that there is a variation in the z direction, okay? Because as it moves down, it changes. At any given point, if you go down, it changes. So you can't say that, you can't cross out both of these and the temperatures that vary in the z direction. It's only crossing off this one and saying it's negligible compared to this term. Not that there still will be a temperature variation in the z direction, okay? So conduction is negligible compared to convection. And that's the final form. So this would be VZ. And then you're able to, and like I said, you have another term here for this viscosity. You left that in for dvz dy, but you're just left with vz, and you can plug it in. You can plug in the v that's given there, but we didn't require many people. Because then you'd actually have everything in terms of y, and you could really, I don't know if you'd be able to solve that differential, but since we didn't require it, I haven't looked into it, but that should be your final answer. And it's kind of interesting to note, if you divide through and just make this some kind of, you can recognize what the constants are. Let's just call it beta for now. This is the unsteady state equation, except for this is a z, okay? We're just saying dTd. T is equal to alpha, and then the second derivative of temperature with respect to a direction. And so that's kind of exactly what we see here. Like, if this was a flat plate, and instead of this being z, this was time, this is how we'd expect it to look. Over time, we would eventually reach steady state where the temperature gradient looked like that. Okay? So that's problem 1A. We're just way too much time. Any questions? Okay. Or B. All right, you have, well, let me say, the common mistakes in the first one was saying DTZ. dt dz is 0, which isn't true. People didn't recognize that vy was equal to 0, and they didn't recognize it was steady state. Okay? This problem here, we have glass, and the glass is right here. This is air in the center. T, say t outside and t inside for now. Okay? And the system, as he says, is the air that's between the two glass plates. And these are at different temperatures. There's no reason to assume that they're the same. Let's say that the TN side is the hotter one, so TI is greater than T0. What it'll look like inside is there'll be convection here, okay? Due to the density gradients. This is hotter over here, so it's going to rise along this wall here. It's going to come down on the cooler side, and this is what we have. This is what we talk about when we have natural convection, and it'll be like this too in here. All right? Maybe 70% of the people didn't recognize that there's natural convection here. They treated this as if it was a solid, and they ended up getting the form that we'd expect for a solid, which is the Laplacian of the temperature, is equal to zero, which isn't correct for air, okay? So starting with that same one up there, and I guess we're writing this here, the same coordinates as the other one. I'll just go through each of these terms. This is also steady state, okay? There's no indication this is a startup, so steady state. This term, like I explained, is not zero for this. Sorry, this is a gas, so this is not zero. It's a gas, so this is not zero. This needs to stay. You can't say it flees because it's incompressible, or because it's definitely not incompressible. Gases aren't incompressible. But also, you can't say anything about the pressure in the situation not changing, or there's a thermodynamic property that pertains to air. Okay, so this is not correct for this case, so that stays. This one, low mu for air, most people were able to pick that up, and so this term is negligible, and there's no generation in the system. Okay, so I'll just rewrite it, be lazy. Keep that term, we'd be left with that over there. The steady state takes it off, those two terms drop off. And then, because there's natural convection happening, there was a coordinate system given, but I accepted it. I had to look at everyone. This probably took me so long as I was looking at everyone's coordinate system to see what they put down. So it's independent of which coordinate system you have, but assuming that z is this way, y is up, and x is into the board, you know that Vx is zero because it's symmetrical in that direction. There's not going to be anything moving over there. So something like symmetry. You don't have to give an answer. Or you could say that dt dx is zero because the temperature doesn't depend on x. So either of those things, and the same thing here. Temperature doesn't depend on x, so this is gone by symmetry. Vy and Vz are present, just based on that diagram that you'd know for natural convection. Temperature gradients are also present because the temperatures are different. It's changing as it's going up. It's changing as it's going over to the left and to the right. These terms are the same thing. They're all present. This right here, we haven't done anything yet with this, but this is the idea of taking the concepts we use and actually applying them. You have an expression for the gradient of a vector, and this is velocity. And so you can rewrite this as what it is. dvx dx plus dvy dy plus dvz dz. And because of symmetry again, this term is, there's no velocity in the x direction. So that's zero. These things remain, and so that's what you put in here, and that's your final form. An optional thing that he had in the solution, but no one did, was saying if this is an ideal gas, you can actually write out what this is, because you know V equals nRT, so you can dP dT, and you can see that would be dP dT, nR over V, right? And then you're multiplying that by temperature, and so then it becomes T nR over V, which is equal to pressure, okay? So this term right here, this whole thing, is equal to pressure for an ideal gas. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? We're just doing this derivative here, and for an ideal gas, this is true. So if you take the derivative of this, if you divide this, it looks like this. So dp dt is nr over b. Okay? Then you stick that in here, and you multiply that by t. And then you're left with, then you get this, which according to the ideal gas equation is equal to p. So this whole thing becomes p. And so you just put a p there, but you don't need to do that, okay? But you did need to recognize that this thing can expand and one of the terms drop off. A lot of people said common mistakes were not realizing that convection is present. Like I said, about maybe 70% of the students didn't do that, didn't recognize that. And then saying this term is zero for a whole slew of reasons, like I said, that it's incompressible, the pressure doesn't change. Remember, it's a thermodynamic property. Okay. Any questions on that one? The key thing for the second problem, again, is recognizing that this is a fin, okay? It's a fin, and that it the exact physical situation, the physical situation is exactly the same as what we know for a fin, except that it's not told you, it's a fin. So it's you having to recognize what it was, how a fin behaved, and seeing this is exactly the same. So everything that we derive from a fin applies to the situation. Right? We even gave you, if this was unclear, this first part, I thought that it might be unclear thinking that this is an unsteady state problem, because it's approximately how long, but you think time. We put up the hint thing that said that we're talking about L for length, not time. Okay, so there shouldn't have been any confusion on that, but a lot of people took this to be an unsteady state problem. The steady state problem, you have a long square copper rod, like that. This end right here is maintained at 100 in the same way that the fin is maintained at T naught at that end, and it's exposed to a fluid at 25 degrees Celsius. You're given the heat transfer coefficient, so you have the temperature, which is T infinity, the K of the copper, and the H of the fluid. Okay? You have those in two places. Okay? So once you recognize the fin, that's why there was such a large standard deviation on this, is because you almost got it, and then you did really well and got a lot of points, or you didn't realize it and you didn't get anything, or you got a very small amount. So once you recognize that it is a fin, nothing was difficult about the problem. After you recognize that was the hardest step, I guess. Solving for the length. Okay. And you're asked to find the minimum temperature. Approximately how long does the rod have to be for the minimum temperature? If you know it's a fin, you know the minimum temperature is at the end of the fin, right there. Okay. So we have the temperature profile for a fin. And this right here is the uninsulated case. What we said is because this is so small, you can assume it's uninsulated, but if you wanted to use his equation and put L sub C in. Well, he did use L sub C in the solution, but you didn't need to have the exact case 2 solution that Professor Thompson had derived, where it's not really necessary for the things that we're dealing with to do that. You can always just modify this case 1 solution with L sub C. Let's see. Yeah, so remember, this is T. We're talking about T minimum occurs at X is equal to L. So you plug in X is equal to L. To L here, this is 0. This is 0. The hyperbolic cosine of 0 is 1. And then you're left with this right here. So the hyperbolic cosine of ML. And then you change this to T minimum. And that, the cosine of ML is equal to 10. And then you solve for M, for this case right here. H you're given, K you're given. Area is the cross-sectional area, as we talked about. It comes out of the derivation. And the perimeter, which is, so you can figure out this. The thickness of this is 25, and there's four sides around, or 0.025 meters. And then you multiply that by 4, that's the perimeter you get. So that's 8 inverse meters. To get this from this step to this step, you do the inverse about cosine of 10, and you get this, and you're left with ML. And plugging in L is equal to this right here, just plugging in the numbers. So in the solution, we used L, you could use L sub C, just the same, either of those would have been just fine. All right. Questions on that part? You can also do it with the charts, and I'll show that method in a second. But then we know that that equation there, heat is lost through a fin, and we just have a fin now, but I have a pipe, so we need to consider any of the parts of the pipe. This is the standard equation, the efficiency of the fin, H times the area of the fin, has the temperature difference. We know all of those things now. We're able to solve for the number 140.5 watts. Questions on that? And then you can also do this from the charts. The charts use L sub C, so look up on the video. You calculate L sub C, you calculate these quantities that the chart's looking for the spin, and you get 2.05 for that quantity. This would be a longitudinal fin, okay, not a circular fin, which looks different. And you can see that the efficiency you get is 0.35, which is different than what you have here. Here we got 0.25. Imagine just looking it up, and I think this would be closer to this if you plug in L sub C here, because you also see this part. Either way, you're done, fine. That's the Q that you get using that method. Okay. Questions on that? Yeah, a key thing was working on the area of the fin, 4 times the length, which is 0.5 meters, and 0.025 was the thickness of each of the sides. You didn't need to include this end because it is pretty small compared to the area here, but you definitely need to include all 4 sides. In the book, the equation for the area of the fin, they're talking about a very thin fin, and so they say like just the top and the bottom they account for, and the sides they ignore, and they use 2 L sub C and W. But in this case, the thickness of the fin is significant compared to the fin that we've seen before, so you need to make sure you include it in. Okay? So as long as you could include this or not, that was fine, but you just need to account for all 4 sides that were exposed to the fluid. Okay? I guess there's no questions. Problem 3. Okay. All right, we have disks here that are being heated in a furnace. You have a thickness and a diameter, and you're initially at the initial temperature at 20 degrees Celsius. And air at 500 degrees Celsius is flowing around them, so they're going to heat up. You have the velocity of that air, and you're given this thing here to characterize the Nusselt number, okay? Important thing to note is that the characteristic dimension is the disk thickness, 5 centimeters. That goes in the Reynolds number, okay? People use 8 centimeters for some reason. When it says specifically to use a disc thickness, you have to use that. And with the Reynolds number, it just needs to have some kind of characteristic dimension for it, okay? And it's kind of arbitrary what you choose. It's just that when you define what Reynolds number are for laminate and turbular regimes, you would take into account whatever length you use. But in this case, you use the disc thickness, so you need to make sure you use that, okay? So this is an unsteady state problem. We can all recognize that, right? It's a lot clearer than the second one, which might have been confusing. You had to recognize that it was a fin, it was an unsteady state. This is unsteady state, and you're talking about temperature. Eventually, you ask for pretty much to find the temperature at a certain time. So what we do when we see these problems is to see what the BO number is. Remember, to compare the resistances in the inside it, the solid and then the gas. And this is ceramic, so you can guess right away that the BO number is going to be large, and you're not going to be able to treat this as a lump sum heat capacity where you can treat the temperature inside it as the exact same all the way through. So if you would have done that and just said, all right, it's a ceramic, BO number is going to be large, I can just go right into the unsteady state looking at the charts, or just like I said before, you can always go right into the chart for unsteady state problems. It's always going to be more accurate than the lump sum some heat capacity method, but it just might be more work. So but if you did that, that's fine. But one of the things that you can do is solve for the BO number, but you can't really. Well, the first thing, before you even get to that, I guess that's for part B. To do part A, heat transfer coefficient. Okay. You just need to calculate these things knowing which the H comes from here. According to this relationship here, H is the Nusselt number times K over L, and you have this expression here, so you need to solve for the Reynolds number using the disk thickness and the Prandtl number. And here you go, this is the density. You need to decide what things they apply to. The Reynolds number are the properties of the gas, air in this case. Plug in the viscosity for that. 1580 is the Reynolds number you have. A lot of people said this is laminar. There's no reason to say it's laminar or turbulent because you're given the equation for finding H already. And also, you don't know if it's laminar or turbulent because of what I said. The disk thickness is a characteristic dimension. Depending on how you change that, it would change the regime for laminar or turbulent flow. So that's incorrect. I already marked that, but didn't take off points for that. So you have 1580 for that, the Prandtl number. Mu, C sub D, and U is for air. Heat capacity for air also, and then the K is for air, okay? Remember that parallel number is a property of the fluid. You could have looked it up for air. I mean, you couldn't in this problem because you're given the numbers, but since you know you can look it up on a chart just for air, you should know that all the properties that go into it are the ones for air, not for the ceramic, okay? And we get 0.641. We're going to move up the Nusselt number with those two numbers, plugging in that equation above, 0.584 is the constant in front. We get 20, and then using this equation right here, we can solve for H, which actually turned out to be the same number he said to assume in part B. He said assume it's 16. Usually, if he says that, he'll give you a new number to start with, just so you have something to go with to do part B. If you couldn't get part A, it happened to be the exact same number, so that was kind of a check for you. If for some reason you got 16, you saw that it was the same as 16, you probably knew you were correct on that one. Okay, and then for part B, this is where you would need to check the BO number, okay? It's kind of hard to see there. Maybe write it on the board. The BO number is equal to H. Now that you know that, the volume over the area times K. You couldn't just use, this is equal to X1, according to the book, and they give you different things for X1. A lot of people took the X1 for a long cylinder. This isn't a long cylinder. This is a short cylinder. Okay, a long cylinder means infinitely long, so there's really no, there's no end effects. There's no area off the end. But in this case, we do, and so you need to account for that. So you figure out the volume of this is pi times 0.04 squared 0.05, which is equal to 0.00. 0 3 meters squared, okay? So it's pi r squared times the height to get the volume. And then A is the surface area, 2 pi times 0.04 squared. And that's accounting for the stuff off the top, because this is pi r squared times 2 of them, because it's the area for the circles on top of this thing, plus pi times the diameter times the height to get the surface area up the sides, okay? 0.05, okay? Which is equal to 0.023 meters squared. And B over A is 0.0133. And now you know this, you already have H, and then K is going to be the K for the solid this time, because the BO number compares, and we're talking about what's going on in the solid compared to what's going on in the fluid. So now the K is going to be that for the granite, which is 0.08 there. And plug those numbers in. Kind of see right there, the zero number is equal to 16 times this divided by 0.08, and this is 2.65, okay? So 2.65 is the value of the zero number, which is greater than 0.1, which is probably what you would expect it to be ceramic. So you do need to use the charts, you can't assume 1 T capacity. And you're asked to find the minimum temperature in the disk after 2,250 seconds, assuming the heat transfer coefficients. Again, if you weren't able to get this, you could start off with it. So you were able to do part B. Remember, if you couldn't do A, try and do B. Pick up whatever points you can, and you know the mean is going to be low. Is it sufficient to increase the minimum temperature to 425? The minimum temperature inside this that's flowing with fluid on the outside is going to be in the center, okay? Lowest temperature, because it starts off there, it's going to be the farthest from the fluid. Minimum temperature is at the center. Now this shape that we have here, it's a cylinder, but as far as how to treat it from the charts, we need to treat it using the tube. Remember we talked about how you need to treat it like two for this very same case here. You have a cylinder, you have the case for a long cylinder where there's no end, there's a case for two flat plates. And you know how to relate those two. I'll show you how to do that, but you need to recognize that. Okay? So you can get M and X for the charts, okay? For both of those charts that we're going to get. And this is the equation that relates them. The Y of the disk for this whole thing is the Y of the cylinder times Y of a plate. And so you're going to be looking at two different charts to get that information. M for cylinder, same K, and M for plate, the same K for both of them, from there. H is the same, it's 16. The X is going to be different. It just depends on how the chart defined X1 as the characteristic dimension. Here it's .04, so it's half of this. This is dimension here for these. For the cylinder, and then for the flat plate, half of this distance from the center up. And so that's 2.5. Right there, 0.025. So you're able to calculate the M for both of those cases. The alpha is the same for both of them. All right, you need to calculate one for each. This is the thermal diffusivity for the solid. Okay, so you can plug in the product of the solid. Get that number there. And from that, looking at the charts, you're able to, you have to calculate X first. The equation for that right there, alpha T over X1 squared. That's why you need to calculate alpha. So you can plug in alpha here. And the time you're given, 2,250 seconds. X1 is the characteristic dimension depending on which system you have. Here it's 0.04 of this, and here you use 0.025, and that's what I'm showing. But it comes up to 1.01 for the plate, and the cylinder is 0.394. So now that you have the M and an X for both the cylinder and the plate, you're able to look on the chart, find the Y, So the Y for the cylinder, 0.4 for this figure. The Y of the plate is 0.2 from that figure. And then we multiply them together. The two Ys, just like we see up here, multiply them together, get the Y for the disk. And then you have the equation for Y. It's not shown here, so I'll write it on the board. Y is equal to T1 minus T over T1 minus T0, okay? And we're looking for this temperature here. T0 is the initial temperature of the solid, and T0 is the initial temperature of the solid, T1 is the temperature of the fluid going outside. And so just multiplying this off, solving for T with Y in there that you got, plugging in 500 is the outside temperature. The initial temperature of the solid is 20, and so you get 462 degrees Celsius, which is in fact greater than 425, so the answer is yes. Okay, and that's everything for that problem. Any questions on that one, or any questions in general about the tests, or anything in the last couple of minutes that we have? We could have some questions. You have a what?
Added wrong.
You added wrong?
No, my points are added wrong.
Oh, okay. Bring it to me afterwards. Question on the test.
Do we have more time on the next one? Is that a fin problem? I don't know. I figured it out at the end.
We don't write the exam. Professor Thompson's the one, so you get to talk to him. But that's just kind of how he's been doing it for many years. And it seems like that's how most of the engineering exams are in chemical engineering. It's that you're given a lot to do, and a lot of times the mean's really low. So that's why a good question to ask professors beforehand before an exam is, you know, what's the typical mean in your exam? And if it's lower, you know, you should have a different way of approaching it. And if it's a high mean, you want to go through and do every part perfectly, and you probably have enough time to do it because most people that do it have enough time if they get a high mean. Otherwise, you want to go around looking for points if there's a low mean. Okay. Other questions? Nothing. Okay, that's it.